The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway for a Monday. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's a constitutional battle we focus on this hour, actually more than one battle. The election in Myanmar solidly delivers a message: no more military dictatorship. That's what the voters have said. But will the military accept it? Will Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi have the chance to see her vision of freedom in Myanmar come to fruition? We'll talk about that later this hour. Also, Vice President Al Gore, the victim of a constitutional battle back in 2001 that gave his rival George W. Bush the presidency, outlines the challenges, and many of them are constitutional, of confronting climate change. Gore on the upcoming Paris meeting on climate change and what it means for sovereign nations. But first, we go to Washington. And, you know, if you say something long enough, people maybe start believing that it's true.
I have said repeatedly that I intend to close Guantanamo, and I will follow through on that.
Guantanamo is not necessary.
I'm going to be doing everything I can to close it.
It is expensive.
We will close the Guantanamo Bay detention camp.
It is inefficient.
That's why I argued that it should be closed throughout my campaign.
But make no mistake, we will close Guantanamo prison.
Guantanamo will be closed no later than 1 year from now.
That is why I ordered the prison at Guantanamo Bay closed by early next year.
Yeah. Guantanamo will be closed. We've heard that quite a lot. That's 7 years of presidential history regarding Guantanamo there in a little montage. The White House says it will proceed to finalize plans to shut down the Guantanamo Bay detention facility in Cuba, a formal proposal to Congress to close the prison expected any day now. Standing in the president's way, though, is the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, which inflicts harsher restrictions on transferring detainees, and if passed, would make it impossible to close the facility. The president would have to veto the NDAA. Here's White House Secretary Josh Earnest last week responding to a question about whether the president would bypass Congress and close the prison through executive order.
At this point, I would not take anything off the table in terms of the president doing everything that he can to achieve this critically important national security objective. And this is a pretty transparent case of the United States Congress putting narrow political interests ahead of national security.
And then there are the narrower political and humanitarian interests of the 112 detainees left in Guantanamo, many of whom would be deported if Gitmo closed. The ones who are still slated for indefinite detention would be sent to secure federal and military prisons in the U.S. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill not happy. Senator John McCain says Obama lacks a clear plan and doesn't want to cooperate with Congress. McCain delivered a similar message back in February.
For the record, in 2009, the then legal counsel of the White House came to my office and met with me and Senator Graham, said they wanted to close Guantanamo. And I said, fine, I do too. Give us a plan. In the intervening years, there has never been a plan forthcoming from the White House.
Carlos Warner joins us now, assistant federal defender in Ohio, who currently represents 10 men detained at Guantanamo. He's on the line from WKSU in Kent, Ohio. Carlos, what is preventing your 10 detainees from going home, from being freed entirely?
Well, they fall into, and John, thank you for having me.
Sure.
They fall into many different categories. So we have some men that are slated for this indefinite detention. We have other men that the government has agreed should be released years and years and years ago. But really politics and international diplomacy stands in the way of their release. So they run the gamut. There's a false narrative out there about who's in Guantanamo. We've been saying it for years. Now it's starting to come to light that many of the men that people on the right have said are the worst of the worst actually aren't bad at all. And this is like bleeding out and leaking out, but it's part of the reason why Guantanamo stays open for sure.
Well, aren't bad at all. They're certainly angry that their lives have been derailed in this way, and they may or may not be bad, but they haven't been accused of crimes in many cases. I mean, they fall outside of the justice system completely, and I'm just uncertain as to what the security issue is here. What does it matter whether they're detained in the United States or at Gitmo? It certainly doesn't affect my security.
That's absolutely true. The idea that men being moved to the U.S. would somehow make us less safe is, again, a false narrative. The idea that keeping Guantanamo open makes us less safe is certainly a true narrative. And the president has talked about that, and it's not a surprise that when ISIS executes a prisoner, they are in orange jumpsuits. It is a direct comment on Guantanamo. So closing Guantanamo makes sense for our country. But again, it's such a political issue now. You know, many people on the right just will not ever say it's okay to close Guantanamo in spite of what the facts are.
Finally, though, you don't seriously expect ISIS to change its stagecraft if detainees are moved to Colorado.
No, but I think that it certainly would cause it's a recruiting tool taken away from them. So it's something that they certainly use in all of, and Al-Qaeda used it as well, continues to use it to recruit new new terrorists. And that's something that the president has attempted to take away for many, many years. And I would agree with Senator McCain that his efforts haven't always been entirely strong on closing the prison. But at the same time, he has been very clear about why it harms our national security. And really, the right has not been clear at all about why leaving the prison open would somehow make us safer. It's just not true.
Well, we'll see if the White House will actually attempt to do this unilaterally. Carlos Warner is assistant federal defender in Ohio. He represents 10 men detained at Guantanamo. He spoke to us from WKSU in Kent, Ohio. Carlos, thanks so much.
Thank you.
What the Michael Brown shooting did everywhere in America was cause communities to ask themselves, could this happen here? In some places, the answer was yes. And in some places, there were additional shootings that raised racial tensions once again. One thing the Brown incident in Ferguson, Missouri did was reveal just how segregated communities in that state are, neighborhood to neighborhood in St. Louis, suburb to suburb across the state. At the NCAA Division I SEC Conference School, the University of Missouri, there's been racial tension over alleged abusive behavior by majority white students against blacks, including school homecoming king Peyton Head.
This isn't just me who is going through this. These are students coming from all different backgrounds who endure this.
That's Peyton Head speaking with KSDK News over the weekend. A graduate student last week, Jonathan Butler, launched a hunger strike demanding that university president Tim Wolf step down. Over the weekend, the Mizzou football team tweeted a statement saying they would not participate in any football-related activities until Wolf resigns. The football coach stands behind his players. Senior Daniela Satori-Cartina is an assistant city editor for the Columbia Missourian. She's been following the protests. Daniela, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
The governor seems to think that Tim Wolf, the president of the university, is late to get involved here. What are the allegations that raise the tension? And what's the likelihood that President Wolf will be forced to step down?
So Jonathan Butler, the graduate student who is undergoing the hunger strike, that's his main goal, to get Wolf removed. There is another group called Concerned Student 1950. They are a student activist group, and they are basically leading these protests. They want Wolf to resign. That is one of their main demands. But they have other demands, including having more black faculty on campus, for example. So yesterday, the UM System Board of Curators, which has the power to remove Wolf, met in a somewhat unofficial meeting. The meeting lasted from, something like 6 p.m. last night. Our reporters of the Missourian, our last reporters, left at about 1 a.m. when Tim Wolf, the president of the university, left this unofficial meeting. Today, the UM System Board of Curators will meet again, and they are going to discuss some personal matters, but we are not sure what they are going to talk about.
Is it your impression that the football team has a lot of leverage here in boycotting the games and not going on the field until Wolf resigns?
That's an interesting question. You know, as a journalist, I try to, you know, keep my public statements a little bit moderate in that way, but just an observation that we have seen in the newsroom at the university. National media really jumped onto this story in the last 24, 36 hours since the football team announced their boycott. But we have seen racist incidents, and we have been covering this story for weeks. Actually, we created a story about the racial climate at MU, and our first date, the first date that we cited as one of the incidents happening was September 12th, when the Missouri Student Association president Peyton Head got called the N-word behind a fraternity house here at Mizzou. So hard to tell, but from that observation, it seems that people have been engaged more with this conversation since the MU football team announced a boycott.
So we have the boycott, the hunger strike. We've got, on the other side, abusive language, allegations, incidents that you've covered, including a very disturbing incident of the tracing of a swastika on some facility.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you describe the details of that?
Well, basically, it emerged about 2 days later after the incident happened that someone basically smeared in feces a swastika in a bathroom in a residence hall on campus. After this happened, several Jewish student groups in particular responded to this event. I know that the Jewish student organization on campus, for example, went to talk to people who live in this residence hall. There's also been a little bit of, let's say, backlash in regards to this incident because a group of 36 organizations related to Jewish-related organizations sent a letter to the EUM chancellor, R. Bowen Lofton, saying that he had not responded to this incident. And so I think one of the main things also to talk about when we talk about this incident is that it's been cited widely as one of the most important things that has happened on our campus that triggered the protests. And I think we have no doubt that, that it has been, but this is only one in a series of many incidents.
How has it affected student life since you are a student, if you could speak personally?
Personally, I don't think I have been able to actually focus on my homework or anything like that for the past few days, you know, but, you know, I'm a journalist and really the work that we do, it's not about us, you know. So one of our reporters actually a couple of days ago went out and spent 2 hours at a camp out. A group of students are camping out in one of our quads in support of Jonathan Butler, the student who is undergoing the hunger strike. And so I remember when we published that story, one of our other reporters tweeted, you know, one of our reporters just spent 2 hours, you know, it was raining, it was cold. He spent 2 hours with the protesters. I can't imagine how it was like for the people who slept there. So while, you know, as journalists and other students unofficially, not in organized groups, have said that the protests are an inconvenience, I can only imagine what it is like to be out there every day being a protester and to go through what Jonathan Butler is going through of this hunger strike that has lasted since last Monday.
Daniela Sartori-Cortina is assistant city editor for the Columbia Missourian. Thanks so much, Daniela.
Absolutely. Thank you.
It is the case that state governments have always been a bad combination of access to lots of tax money, less than secure oversight, and a lawmaking apparatus accustomed to operating in the dark and where small fish can become big bosses who sometimes commit big crimes and end up serving big sentences in federal prisons. When the New York State Capitol building was finished back in 1899 in Albany, it had taken nearly 30 years to build, and at $25 million, it was the most expensive government building of its time. And possibly not all of that money actually made it into the walls, foundation, and glittery dome there in Albany. A new investigation released today by the Center for Public Integrity suggests that this murky tradition continues in state governments around the United States. The 2015 State Integrity Investigation, a data-driven probe of state-level government, found that complete transparency and accountability are pretty much non-existent at the state level. Of the 50 states, only three scored higher than a D+. Gordon Witkin is executive editor for the Center for Public Integrity. Gordon, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, if only three states scored higher than a D+, it could be that your grading system is a little skewed.
Well, we've heard that, but we would respectfully reject that criticism. The research began in 2011. We did this once before. We interviewed 100 experts in state government and came up with 245, we think, objectifiable indicators that comprise a pretty good test of a state's accountability transparency, openness, ethics, and protection against corruption. I mean, we had no preconceived notions, and we certainly did not want to grade on the curve. So I think I would stand behind the results.
Can you give me a sense of an idealized state government that would have gotten a good grade, a grade above a C? I mean, the only three with the grades of C are Alaska, California, and Connecticut.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, the biggest problems that we found, we had 13 categories. Ethics enforcement was a big problem across the board. Public records laws were riddled with loopholes and exemptions. Political financing has become a free-for-all. So many states did get A's in a category or two. We found internal auditing and IG functions to be pretty strong across the 50 states. There'd been an improvement in budget processes in terms of openness. Some budget processes are now available on TV. So there were a couple categories that scored well. But overall, the results were, I think, a bit depressing.
Now, let's talk about the state that did the worst, Michigan. Is there anything that clearly sets Michigan apart, or is it just a kind of mathematical calculation from all of these metrics that you have?
Well, it's pretty much a mathematical calculation. I mean, we try to do objective scoring on each of the 245 categories, and then we simply put the two categories together. There is an atmosphere in Michigan where there are just not a lot of systems in place to be responsible for ethics, providing citizens with access to information, internal investigative capabilities, etc. I would add, John, that there are some states, particularly some plains and western states, who have a more libertarian, limited view of government, who have made it clear they really don't care much what an investigative newsroom in Washington has to say, that they like it that way, that their states are like neighborhoods, and they don't want a lot of detailed systems in place to do this sort of scrutiny. From the first time around, my favorite anecdote was from a state senator in Wyoming who said, "Do you know why you don't have to use your turn signals in Wyoming?" And the answer was, "Because it's nobody's damn business where you're going." So there is certainly a government philosophy that is responsible for some of these differences, but our argument would be that if you have none of the systems in place to root out corruption or hold people's feet to the fire, then you really don't know what might be going on.
Well, and that really says something in Wyoming, because there's only really six roads in Wyoming. That's an exaggeration, of course. What would the federal government have gotten on this grade? Would they be an A? Would they be a B? Are they significantly better than the states?
Well, this would be pure speculation,
sure,
on my part,
of
but I suspect that the federal government would score modestly better overall because there are more of these systems in place. And you know, with things like the Government Accountability Office, the IGs across agencies, that electoral oversight, those sorts of things, I suspect the results would be a little bit better. The other thing that is very much a mixed bag in the states is the part-time legislator concept. I mean, I think in concept, many of us are warm and fuzzy about the idea that citizen legislators who aren't full-time politicians are taking care of the government's business. But as state governments have increased, there are a lot of conflicts that are inherent in that system. These people have full-time jobs, and the priorities and needs of their full-time jobs fairly often conflict with what they're being asked to vote on, and they're largely responsible for recusing themselves, and that process we found doesn't go particularly well. In one state, we found a legislator who was arguing for a bill to ban cities from making their own regulations on use of plastic bags. But he also happened to be the executive director of the State Grocers Association.
There's a big shocker. In many cases, the states only started doing modern budgeting techniques within, you know, the last century. State governments got their act together fairly recently in terms of American history. Is that correct before we go?
Well, I think some did. I think some have not. I mean, in New York, as you're probably aware, we still have the so-called three men in a room system, where it's essentially just three guys who make the ultimate decisions on the budget with very little scrutiny.
And, you know, maybe it'll be two guys and a woman in a room, which would really advance things here in New York. Gordon Wittkin, executive editor of the Center for Public Integrity Investigative Newsroom in Washington, D.C., taking a look at the state governments, and of the 50 states, only three scored higher than a D-plus on their evaluations. Gordon, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A long time coming, an historic election in Myanmar, and one of the world's most closed societies, appears to be opening up in a big way. Opposition leader and Nobel Prize recipient Aung San Suu Kyi is expected to have won the country's first free elections in 25 years. Aung San Suu Kyi emerged from 15 years of house arrest back in 2010, the leader of the National League for Democracy Party. She's the daughter of the country's founder, U Aung San. Joining us now is Thomas Fuller, reporter with our partner, The New York Times, in Myanmar. What's the feeling on the streets?
Oh, it's electric. I mean, people are really jubilant, and people who have never voted in their lives, and you know, they woke up at 4 a.m. and they studied the handout showing them how to vote, and you know, this was a real thrill for them.
And it's taken so long; it's been a kind of a chess game. This has not resembled anything of a revolution that, at least in my lifetime, you have the junta really agreeing to step aside slowly, and Aung San Suu Kyi really taking her time in pushing this, and all of a sudden, she's very successful.
Well, I mean, this was, you know, very different since the Arab Spring. You had a dictatorship that was very brutal, but very unsuccessful in bringing investment and wealth to the country. And the generals realized that. And so they opened up on their own terms. And that's the process that you described that's been just unfolding for years and years.
Does the military have to accept a 70% victory, which is what's projected for Aung San Suu Kyi's party? And does that constitute a mandate? And if the money rolls in, if investment rolls in, does that encourage the military to basically go back to the old ways?
Well, the ruling party, which is the political proxy for the military, and the military itself, they've been quite clear that, you know, they will accept the results of a free and fair election. Now, you know, what often happens is the whoever doesn't agree with the outcome find some fault in the process. But we haven't seen that yet. The precedent, obviously, is not very encouraging. In 1990, Aung San Suu Kyi won a landslide like she seems to be doing now. And the military's answer then, 25 years ago, was to cancel the elections.
What's the likelihood that Aung San Suu Kyi has been manipulated into a corner here and will emerge as something of a figurehead, that they've played her?
She certainly is circumscribed by the constitution that the generals wrote. I mean, she's not allowed to be president, for one. So she says she's going to work by being above the president and by appointing the president if she wins. That is yet to be seen, whether, you know, the military will put up with that. But I think in a larger sense, this is it's a system that is really rigged towards the military in many ways. They have their safeguards, and we'll see, you know, in the next few weeks whether she's successful at that.
Aside from the maneuvers on the streets, though, people are believers.
People are really believers. I mean, it's really touching to meet people who say, you know, I haven't been able to eat since the election yesterday because I'm just so excited. It's refreshing. It's touching. It's poignant to see people so motivated by this notion that, you know, their whole lives they've been guided by what the military wanted for them, and now it's their choice. Now they get to go into a booth and choose who they want to run the country.
Talking about people on the streets excited in Yangon in Myanmar, Thomas Fuller is Southeast Asia correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Thomas, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Having something that's exclusive and secret and puts you close to the center of power can be hard to resist. Did you know that there's nearly a million people living in the Washington, D.C. metro area who hold top secret security clearances? They constitute a kind of security industrial complex of federal intelligence agencies and private intelligence contractors. And many of them get there by way of colleges and university programs that constitute recruiting operations funded by intelligence agencies and led by administrators at the universities with strong ties to the intelligence industry. Veteran defense and national security writer and analyst William Arkin is a consultant to Vice News. He analyzed and ranked the 100 most militarized universities in America. He's been covering the growth of the clandestine agencies for more than a decade. William Arkin, welcome.
Thank you, John.
So you co-authored a piece for Vice that attempted to do what?
Well, we had access to an extraordinary data set of material, which was the backgrounds and resumes of 90,000 people who work in the intelligence community. So from that material, we were able to extract where they went to school. And it's just the first product of this work. But we thought it was particularly interesting because as we looked at the backgrounds of these people with top secret clearances, these people who man the NSA and the CIA and the FBI and military intelligence, what we saw was a pattern that was really interesting. And that was that they weren't the Yale, Princeton graduates of old that we have in our kind of mythical view of the intelligence world. That in fact, they were graduates of not only mediocre schools, but mostly of online schools.
What would you say constitutes a militarized university? That they get most of their money from the Pentagon and the intelligence budget, or that their focus is militarization and information science and cybersecurity, that sort of thing?
So when we used the word militarized, we debated it amongst ourselves. At first, we called them the undercover universities, and we settled upon militarized because we thought that it was important to make the case that what is militarized today is not the same as what we think of in our head, that it's not guns, that today information is really the core of our military and intelligence capabilities. And so these are indeed the most militarized schools, which is to say they produce the most students who go on to work in the intelligence and national security sector of our economy. Secondly, they get the most money from the military or the intelligence community in terms of their research dollars. And third, they reap the most profit and benefit from the veterans and the active duty soldiers whose tuitions are paid for. And so they not only profit, but they also at the same time produce. Now,
what do they produce, though? I mean, we're not talking about the Alan Dulleses of the world. These aren't producing policy geniuses. Are they, on the other end of the spectrum, robot coders?
Well, this is a really difficult question for me to answer personally, John. I'm a veteran of Army intelligence. I graduated from the University of Maryland when I was in the Army in Germany. University of Maryland is still the number one most militarized university in America. So I have neither I'm not saying that these aren't smart people. I'm not saying that they aren't educated. But here's the truth. Of the top 100 liberal arts colleges in America as ranked by national rankings like U.S. News and World Report, not one of them appears in our list of the 100 most militarized schools in America. Not one. And so whatever influence the liberal arts, whatever influence history, whatever influence the Harvards have in this world is meager. The truth of the matter is that most people are getting degrees in information sciences and systems engineering. We even found a school that specializes in the black budget, in training people just to be able to do the business work of contracting in the black budget. It's Villanova. And you would think, why is Villanova one of the top 100 schools in America that has a relationship with the national security state? And the answer is because so many people who have graduated with an MBA or a management degree from Villanova go on to be the green eye shade people of the black budget. We see it in their resumes.
Would you describe these schools and these institutions as a possible pathway to espionage?
Well, I would, in the sense that I think that there is clearly a preponderance of national security work being done in a smaller and smaller number of schools because it's less and less relevant in a way.
So you could plant a spy,
yes,
in one of these schools?
I suppose you could. But the second thing is that what we're spying about today, whether it's the United States or the Chinese when we talk about Chinese cyber espionage, is information. It's patents, it's ideas, it's things that are going to be valuable in the creation of tomorrow's information technologies, because after all, that's the war we're fighting. We're fighting information wars. And so no one is stealing the secret of the atom bomb, which is to say nobody in Russia or China is stealing that secret. They already have it. What they're stealing the secret of are, how does the NSA do X, Y, or Z, or how do you crunch big data, or how do you solve the problem of cybersecurity? And ironically, we're building an army of cyber-capable students and an army of keyboard warriors who are not necessarily – don't think of them as people who are on the front lines, if you will. These are the people who are running the networks and who are running the processors and who are running the storage mechanisms. They are literally the infantry of our day. What this study shows us is that we have to change our view to think today that the infantry is no longer the hundreds of people carrying guns backed up by one or two intelligence officers. It's the other way around now. It's the hundreds of people in the intelligence community who are feeding the one or two people who carry guns in the front lines.
The top five, again, of these militarized schools?
Number one is the University of Maryland. Number two is American Military University, an online school. Number three is University of Phoenix, an online school. And then from there flows just basically a list of Washington-based schools. George Mason, George Washington, Georgetown, they're all in the top 10. And other schools that begin to show up a little bit later are the powerhouse schools of research and development for the Defense Department, Johns Hopkins, Carnegie Mellon, Penn State, et cetera, because they get hundreds of millions of dollars a year from the intelligence community.
William Arkin, defense and national security consultant to Vice News. And your co-author on this latest study?
Is Alexa O'Brien. She's fantastic.
Thank you so much. President Obama's plans for his post-presidency and some of the conversations he's been having with people he respects about that are candid and fresh and fascinating for what the president is hearing as well as what he's asking.
Yeah, we could knock off another percentage point on the unemployment rate if we started rebuilding roads and bridges and,
exactly,
and airports. Yeah, it's, you travel. It's embarrassing,
yes,
when you go to other airports in other countries. Ours used to be the nicest ones.
We will hear more of a remarkable conversation between President Obama and Iowa writer Marilyn Robinson later this week. If things stay as they are, President Obama will leave office in 2017 scandal-free for the first time since Eisenhower and capping the longest continuous period in American history of presidents leaving office alive. The models for the post-presidency are big. There's Jimmy Carter's long Nobel Prize-winning quest to make a difference in conflict resolution and public health. There's Bill Clinton's shorter quest to get rich himself and to get rich people and celebrities to change the world. George W. Bush paints on his Texas ranch well out of sight while his father jumps out of balloons and criticizes his son's administration. But the post-vice presidency of Al Gore may be bigger than all of them. He's had a steep run of credibility since he was a joke on Saturday Night Live.
Governor Bush, why have you consistently refused to meet with me so we can end this political infighting? Cuts.
But since the electoral debacle of 2001, of course, Al Gore has become a serious and leading advocate for the planet, explainer-in-chief for a world that needed a wake-up call on the devastating effects of global warming. He produced a hit movie, An Inconvenient Truth. He won a Nobel Prize and an Oscar for that, and today is rallying people around the world in advance of the climate change meeting in Paris next month of 190 countries. For the first time, the hope is that pragmatic steps will be taken to turn things around. Gore will be there, and before the conference gets underway, as part of his role of chairman at the Climate Reality Project, This week, he'll host a 24-hour global day of action to mobilize people around the world. I had a chance to speak with the vice president this month in a conversation we will air for you in three parts. Gore astutely predicted the downfall of the Keystone XL pipeline. He talked with me about the presidential campaign and conveyed an infectious optimism about the cause he helped to put on the radar.
The predicted impacts of the climate crisis are now visible, and people are experiencing them viscerally. We've had 7 once-in-a-thousand-year downpours in the U.S. Just in the last few years. Every single day on the news, it's like a nature hike through the Book of Revelation. The droughts, including in California and in other places around the world I won't list, the disruption of agriculture, the melting of ice and the rising of sea levels. I was in Miami last month, and fish from the ocean were swimming in some of the streets on a sunny day because it was a high tide. And high tide didn't used to fill the streets of South Florida.
Fish in the street at high tide in South Florida because of sea level rise. Two smart people, Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush, running for president of the United States. Neither one of them talking seriously about climate change. What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, it's kind of weird, isn't it? And it's part of a larger picture in which the United States is the only nation in the world where one of the principal political parties rejects science. And, you know, in the South, there's an old saying, if you see a turtle on a fence post, you can be pretty sure it didn't get there by itself. You know, 100 years ago, one of your predecessors in journalism, Upton Sinclair, wrote, "It's hard to get a man to understand something if his salary depends upon him not understanding it." And if you substitute campaign contributions for salary and lobbyist spending, then, you know, that's right at the heart of why a lot of politicians want to reject the science altogether. And just as some of them did what the tobacco companies wanted to do years ago, they're doing what the carbon polluters want now. But it is particularly surprising in Florida, isn't it? I mean, I just imagine in my mind's eye that governor sloshing through the sea level in the streets there and saying, "I don't notice anything. Do you notice anything?" I mean, it's just it's painfully absurd, and I don't think they can keep it up much longer.
Now, does that count as me having dragged you into the presidential election contest?
Does a Q&A on sea level rise?
Well, no. You've talked about two candidates right now sloshing around in the water, and you mentioned the Republican Party. What do you want to say about the presidential candidates?
Well, is it this November? Oh, wait a minute. It's a year from now, isn't it?
There you go.
I think I'll wait on that.
All right. You know, thinking about the presidential election and the place America is right now, as someone who's been a politician all your life, what do you think is the most amazing political change in America and around the world from the awareness of climate change? And how do you think that's going to have an impact on the top-down discussions that will take place at the conference in Paris?
The biggest change in American politics that I've seen in my lifetime is the intrusion of big money. It's awful now. Our democracy has been hacked, John. The operating system no longer works for the American people. Big money writes the laws and the rules, and when they say jump, there are too many politicians that reflexively ask how high. Now to the point of your question, the reality of the climate crisis has now sunk in. People get it. There are still a few deniers out there, of course. There always will be. There are some people who still think the moon landing was faked. But the vast majority of people, even if they don't want to use the words, they know now that it's real. And they know we got to solve it. And that's why you're seeing so much progress in the lead up to this meeting in Paris. And that's why I'm so excited about 24 Hours of Reality, November 13 and 14 with the live Earth performances. And then, of course, at the end of the month, November 30th through the first half of December, every nation in the world will be sitting down at that table, hammering out the final disagreements. Most of the text is done already. This is going to be a success. We're going to get an agreement. And it's going to contribute to the tremendous change that's underway.
Well, what a hopeful sound of the power to the people. Your people are about ready to kill me for talking to you for so long. But just remind me, the moon landing, that was real?
Yeah. You covered it, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Absolutely. You got my age pegged right there. Al Gore, it is so great to talk to you. Take care.
You too, John. Always. Thank you. Bye-bye.
We'll have more from Vice President Al Gore later this month and the Friday after Thanksgiving in the Takeaway's hour-long lead-up coverage to COP21, the United Nations Conference on Climate Change in Paris, where leaders from around the world will formally adopt a new global agreement on climate change. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.